Hello and welcome to another episode of a three-pronged podcast, series two. We're cracking on with them now. So when we set up this podcast, the one thing we wanted to do was not only talk to people from agriculture and farming and all the other related stuff, we also thought we'd like to talk to people that probably have not much connection with farming, but have an interest because they eat food. So this evening we've got on Tom Fordyce. So Tom is somebody that many of you will know. So Tom's had a long and illustrious career in sports journalism, starting off with the BBC, which basically he's just told us started by going on a drunken tour around France in a bus with his mate. And from those foundations, he's built a very successful career. And recently, he left the BBC a couple of years ago to sort of paddle his own canoe. And you may know him from such podcasts as the Geraint Jones one, Joe Marler one, which obviously I was had the great pleasure of being on, and a couple of other ones as well, I expect so, Tom. So thank you very much for coming along this evening, Tom.
It's nice to see you all. I know it's taken us a while to get here, Neil. You know, our diaries were busy, but we've made it happen.
We have.
Even if it is late at night, it doesn't feel that late because it's a June evening and there is still some daylight in the sky.
It still looks nice outside. It still looks good.
It's cold. It probably looks nice than it is, having just been out in it. Flav, you've been chasing pigs more recently than I've been outside, so you can probably give us a better update on conditions.
Well, I'm sweating, so it's quite warm for me.
Flav spends his life. So, going on with the, as we like to start all our shows, with the good, the bad, and the ugly. So, I'm going to drop out this week. So, who's going to take the good?
I'll take the ugly.
You're going to take the ugly.
I did have an ugly. We could. Can we double ugly, or is the format set?
Yeah,
in stone?
Double ugly.
Yeah, double ugly.
Double ugly. Chris, what are you going for? You've got a choice to do.
I'm going to be good on the week that the Euros start. As any sports fan, we're full of optimism. Everyone's going around saying it's coming home. We've got probably on paper the best squad. So. Yeah, like many, I am fully behind the boys. Probably going to be disappointed when we get knocked out in the quarters or the semis on penalties. But I'm not going to think like that tonight. I am positive, and it's great. It's great when the country comes together and unites behind one cause. And I think before balls be kicked, I think we're all behind the boys. And let's hope we can bring it home.
And obviously this podcast goes out to the other regions in the UK. So I'd like to step in and say good luck to Scotland. I won't say good luck to Wales and follow our Prime Minister because that would be a massive mistake.
I can tell you one thing for sure. They're not wishing us good luck, so I don't see the point in us wishing them good luck.
I'm just trying to be nice. All of them. Brad, what's your ugly?
I'm back to my old routine of chasing pigs back in at least once a week. It started off with 24 being on the road on Saturday night. I was chasing them in till 11:30 at night. And I had some yesterday and some today. So, I hope this stops.
I did see your social media at night with your pig chasing.
Don't. It's not fun anymore.
Flav looks exhausted.
He's very tired. And what about you? What's your ugly, Tom?
Well, this really is quite an ugly one. I'm going to share something personal with you. So last week I had a colonoscopy. I don't know if any of the three of you have ever had a colonoscopy. Let's not even get to the bit where they're basically sticking a camera up your ass. Before you even get to the point where they stick a camera up your ass, they have to make sure there is nothing up there. To obstruct the view. So 24 hours before you go in, you're given this powder to mix up in your your milkshake protein shaker. It doesn't taste great. And then nothing really happens for about 40 minutes, and then you get a sort of a sense of uncertainty. And then things start to happen. There's a clip that I've subsequently been sent where Billy Connolly talks about his colonoscopy and the great clear out before the great invasion. And he describes sitting on the toilet and it being like someone, you know, when you've got a hose on full blast, but no one's holding on to the end of the hose and it's just That's pretty much what it was like. So that is the ugly from me.
Jesus Christ.
I can beat that because unfortunately last year I had to have a front colonoscopy, if that makes sense.
Yes. Oh. Up the two one-way valves.
Yes.
Oh, God.
They found, for whatever reason, blood in my urine and they were concerned that I might have bladder cancer, let's be honest. And luckily I didn't. But I went to the hospital thinking I'm just going to go and chat to a surgeon. And I waited and I went into the urology department, walked into a room, and I can laugh about it now. I just walked in to find like a bed there, two nurses and a bloke sat at a desk. And I'm thinking, nah, there ain't going to be any talking today. I'm not going to go into the rest of the detail, but I left a different man. Also, what I'm saying. But luckily, it was all good. So
were you knocked out? Or
no.
Were you awake?
No. And then they said, do you want to watch? I was like, no,
absolutely not. No way.
I'm good, thank you for watching. Yeah, no, it's brutal. So, anyway, moving on from colonoscopies and front colonoscopies. Tom, so you're somebody that obviously you've worked in sports journalism for a long, long time. I've met you quite, a couple of times now. And you're somebody that obviously takes care of yourself. You know, you're into running, health and fitness is really, really important to you. So when you're sort of like, you're doing all of this sort of health and fitness, what are you thinking about when you eat? Let's just start on that.
That's a very good question. I think a lot of time, obviously, the more exercise you do is nice because you can get away with eating more, number one, can't you? You've got that really nice relationship where, your body requires calories and there'll be a certain point in the day. Like a good run early on today, I did about an hour's intervals. And I had a decent sized lunch about 3 hours later, 2-3 hours later, I was really hungry. And you know that way, and you'll know this because you're working agriculture and you're on your feet all day and it's a physical job. That sort of righteous hunger you get when your body's going, come on, I don't want to play games here. I want another proper meal. So I think as you get older, I think when you're younger, you're a bit more gung-ho, aren't you, about your diet because you can't ever see the end coming and you can't see illness and you just feel totally invulnerable to everything. As you get a bit older, I'm 50 now, you start thinking, what would happen if I did this? And you try out a few different dietary things, don't you? I tend to find I eat more in winter, like all of us, when it's cold and it's dark, and in summer you're out and about a bit more. But as you know, Neil, I am, and I'm going to say this, knowing that I'm in a safe place and there'll be no booing from the other guests on the pod. I'm a vegetarian. I'm officiating vegetarian. Now, this is slightly controversial in my wider family because my mum's side of the family are all farmers and they're working agriculture. So my mum grew up on a farm out on the Essex marshes that was an arable farm and a dairy farm. And when I was a kid, I would spend lots of time on my grandparents' farm, which is out in a place called Burnham on Crouch out in deepest Essex. So most of the extended family have roles in agriculture. Usual story, the eldest son got the, because there was eight kids, the eldest son got the farm. The next son, what did he get? He got a combine, I think. I think he got the combine. The next brother became a butcher. The next brother worked in farming insurance, and that has sort of dripped its way down through the family tree. So a lot of the family on my mum's side still work in farming or associated industry. So you can imagine what it's like when you're, I'm the black sheep. You can imagine what it's like, Chris, where you go to a family gathering. So another one of the uncles has got a hog roasting business. It's one of his sidelines.
Wow. So
I would go up, you'd go up to the hog roast, there'd be like a big old knees up in a barn somewhere, big bar set up behind the bales, and everyone's going up to get their hog roast. And I'd go up and I'd get my bun, the first bit, and then the pig's there, and I'd go, what's the veggie option? And they just give me my apple sauce and that'll be it.
Hog roasting business, do you have a veggie option?
No.
Yeah, mate, you're going to cater for everyone. So I normally either do, I used to either do halloumi.
Ooh.
And portobello mushroom.
Yeah, or, nice.
Falafel and hummus until I did a hog roast when it was windy and the halloumi didn't crisp up. It looked boiled. So I said, I'm not doing halloumi and hog roast again. So now it's either pig or falafel and hummus, and it seems to go down well.
Yeah, I would take that, I think. I think when you go, you know, when you first see a hog roast, there's a lot of excitement. Hog roast seems to go down very, very well with drunk people. I don't know why. I don't know if it's the fat, it's the crispiness, it's the aromas.
Yeah.
You know, the sort of thing, it's the, if it makes an appearance late in a wedding, the happiness around the wedding. Seriously, you've got a hog roast. Oh, get in.
Yeah, it is. You can't, anywhere that's got a hog roast, it's just brilliant. It is like the future, it really is. So why are you a vegetarian?
So when I was a kid, big farming family, big Irish farming family. I think what probably happened there is, so I was one of five kids, let alone my mum being one of eight kids. And there was certainly just to feed us, just to fill us all up. So we probably got, with all due deference to my mum, who's, you know, a really good cook, we got a lot of food that was just there to fill you up. So a lot of cuts of meat that have since been rehabilitated, but when you're a kid, you don't necessarily like belly of pork. We used to have belly of pork quite a bit. So when you're a kid, that just feels like fatty meat. You know, that's what it seems like. There was a lot of mint, you know, again, just because you could stick a mince anything, you could stick mashed potato with a mince and fill up 500 kids, hungry kids. So I think that there's some really nice meat in there as well. But when I went away to college, I first of all didn't really miss meat. I mean, it's expensive when you're a student, isn't it? But I didn't really miss it. And because I ate fish, that was okay. And then I gradually started eating a bit less of it. And then it was almost like once I stopped eating it, then it sort of broke the connection with a meaty diet, and it became a slightly stranger idea, the idea of eating meat. There weren't many male vegetarians at that point, so I went vegetarian when I was 21. So when was that? 94, 95. Mm-hmm. And when I went traveling, around the world, sometimes it would be easy and sometimes it would be really hard. Like you went to, even hopped across to Germany, and in Germany apparently ham isn't meat. ham's not meat. South Africa, you can imagine what that's like. People just think you're insane. South America is really weird, because in South America, obviously in Argentina and Uruguay, massive beef producers, and you know, in Chile, they love their meat as well. And I remember backpacking around those places, and sometimes you turn up a little cafe and you say soy vegetariano, and they'd look at you, be a nice old dear running the restaurant, and then she'd bring you a plate of pasta and she'd give you a little wink as she walked off, and you'd part the pasta and there's a massive great steak underneath it, and she'd just give you a little nod. So as you get older, I think all my family still eat meat. You know, as I say, there's a lot of farmers in the family. The question I had was, when I had kids, what did I do? Because my partner's vegetarian as well. And it was a really interesting decision, and we decided to bring our kids up eating everything as omnivores. Because for us, it had been a decision that we took when we were adults. And I sort of felt, well, maybe it should be the same for our kids. You know, I think it's good, probably good for kids to eat as much a wider range of foods as they can. And you don't want fussy kids. And I was like, well, okay, the boys can eat what they like. You know, it's slightly easier from a protein point of view, because kids aren't going to get loads of pulses and tofu down them, are they? But we thought we'd give them the choice. So they are now 13 and 10. The 13-year-old is a big, strong boy. Prefers eating fish to meat, but he will have a bit of meat, and the younger one will eat whatever he can get his hands on. He is a carnivore through and through.
Are you okay cooking meat?
Yeah, because I cook it for the boys. It's fine. It's, do you know what? It's, I think you probably get different sorts of vegetarians. I mean, like I say, for me, it started off as just a taste thing. And then I was quite happy with the range of foods that I could eat. I really enjoyed doing the boys' good chicken. I have found it interesting since I've become close friends with Mr. Marler, because obviously he loves his meat. And as Neil probably knows, when we do our recording days in the studio, we go out for a lunch and it's a massive lunch. Joe has two lunches to my one lunch, and he likes a lot of meat. Some of my vegetarian friends are probably more radical than me. I think maybe because I grew up in a really dairy environment, spending all their summer holidays on dairy farm. I still love dairy. I love milk. You know, I'd have milk any time of the day, full fat milk, because we used to drink unpasteurized milk on the farm. So I'm probably not the most radical of vegetarians, but I don't know. Sometimes the arguments, particularly when you look at the cost of cheap meat, I think some of those arguments are still quite attractive to me. And maybe over the course of doing the Joe Marler show, when we talk to people like you, Neil, and we talk to Dom, obviously, our butcher, You know, I don't think I'll go back to meat, but I can see the argument of eating really well-prepared, good meat that has a positive effect on the environment. And I see that probably now is very different to mass-produced, cheap processed meat, you know, where there isn't that same care through the, you know, through the supply chain, the same care for the environment and the animals.
I think you make a really good point there, isn't it? Because it does just come down to, like, quality, doesn't it? You know, and that's the one thing we have this, you know, running theme throughout our podcast is talking to people who produce food. And whether it's somebody, you know, we've had arable farmers on here that produce quinoa and really high quality grains and vineyards, you know, to some people that are, you know, growing some fantastic meat, as, you know, Flav and Chris both do themselves. But it always comes down to quality. And I think that's something that the public need to realise. And I think it's a real shame. Because people really realise where the food comes from, like this ultra-processed, horrible, nasty stuff and cheap meat is, it's rubbish. You know, it really is, you know, and when you can go out and get some really, really good quality meat, and it's not expensive. You can go to your local butchers and it's not expensive.
Not that expensive.
Not some that butchers expensive, take the piss. Yeah, it's not cheap, but you're paying...
I've been places where they sell fillet of beef for 70-odd pound a kilo, like, what? It doesn't make any sense. I don't know what you'd have done to a cow to make it worth that much.
Well, it's had its featuring by me, probably. The farmer's like looking to recoup some of that money.
Pay less.
I've got a question, Tom.
Yeah,
you mentioned there about in 1994 you were one of the few male vegetarians. Yeah. Why is it that? And this is a conversation I've had with my partner Nikki, because when I met her first in 2020, she was vegetarian / vegan, and I didn't tell her I was a farmer till after talking to her. Well, I'd tell her I was a pig farmer until after like 3 weeks in. I just said I was a farmer, and like there's always this thing, even when you look at like historical TV adverts, like American ones, it's like be a man, eat a steak, eat a big burger, and I don't know what your thoughts are about meat and sort of masculinity. Because when you look in the wild, like even lions, the females hunt. The male turns up, unless it's like a big buffalo or like a giraffe, the male will just turn up to take his chunk and leave. So I don't know why for humans it's assumed that manliness and carnivorousness are linked.
That is a really interesting point. I mean, when I was a kid, so my dad is now, he's in his early 80s, and he was that post-war generation who grew up with rationing. So to him, you know, meat was a luxury. And then when meat was no longer a luxury, when he was, I guess, in his sort of mid-20s, and then when I was growing up, then I think his attitude was that it wasn't a proper meal unless he had a bit of meat on it. And he would eat all sorts. He was that, you know, he would eat liver on Thursdays, you'd have kidneys on toast. You know, it was proper old school meat eating. You know, we're not talking about steaks and stuff like that. We're talking about all sorts of meat. And I probably absorbed some of his feelings on it. But what I noticed now, if let's say I go out for dinner with some of my younger colleagues, is I think there's probably two things that have changed it. One is that it's much easier to be vegetarian now. Partly because all the plant-based stuff, partly because I suppose it's you know, it's there are more vegetarians and therefore more places want to cater for you. But people are much more blasé about it. Like even being a vegan, when I was a kid, even being a vegetarian was rare. Like vegan was super rare. And you seem to get more people now who are sort of hovering. It's not quite as black and white as it used to be, Flav, I don't think. You know, I've got friends who will, you know, they will eat meat, but the majority of the time they will have plant-based food, and then the meat will be a real treat, and it will be a nice cut of meat maybe once or twice a week. So it doesn't seem like the battle lines are drawn like they maybe were in the, you know, in the late 80s and the early 90s, and, you know, becoming a vegetarian might be quite a strong political statement for people. I think there is there is an in-between area now where people will go, do you know what, for various ethical reasons or for cost reasons, whatever it is, 4 or 5 days of the week, I might, you know, or maybe 2 or 3 days of the week, I might be vegetarian. I might have fish a couple of nights, and I might have meat a couple of nights. And maybe that's the where we're going to. I don't know. What do you think, Chris?
Yeah, I think for me, it's it's quite nice to talk to someone like you that is a vegetarian and your thoughts on it and explain why you are a vegetarian. What sometimes frustrates me is it's probably both sides, both from the farming food community and from especially the vegan community that sort of constantly bash the other side. Oh, you're eating meat, you're destroying the planet. And then farmers go, oh, well, yeah, you're not going to get the protein needed and being a vegan and it's stupid. I think for me, what you want to eat from your own morals and your own views is perfectly fine, but really it's not shoving it down sort of everybody's necks and just making your own choices and going by that. I've got quite a few vegetarian friends. And yeah, but like we say, we always just make an effort, make sure there's something vegetarian for dinner that they can have, and it doesn't mind. And they never try and push me down that. Oh, why do you eat meat? Why do you produce meat? And I think, yeah, really, as a society, we just need to be more understanding on each other's views on it, and make your own choices.
No, definitely. I mean, my mum's vegetarian and has been vegetarian for about, Christ knows, probably 40 years, something like that.
Yeah.
And she's a farmer's daughter and, you know, in and around farming her whole life. And she, you know, she's got some real clear views on why she doesn't eat meat. And I completely get it. So, you know, my mum, very similar to you in many ways, Tom, was, you know, she would quite happily cook me a shepherd's pie or something like that or whatever. But she would never eat it herself. You know, and to this day, she's still vegetarian. She didn't even eat fish either, bless her. But yeah, it's
even on a meat basis. So like, me and Flav both produce goat meat, and like, I'm from Cumbria. Cumbria is probably the most undiverse county in the country because apart from farming and the odd and Sellafield, the nuclear place, there's not much sort of industry or business. So it's a very sort of traditional society. I remember I told my grandma that I was going to start producing goats for meat, and she literally thought I'd lost the plot. I think if she could have put me in a mental asylum, she would have done. She just disgust. And even like some other family members thought I was mad until it went into a local food hall, Cranston's, that some of them supply with beef, and then it was fine that it was in there, and it's fine, and since my grandma has had it and enjoyed it. But yeah, it was just the fact, oh, that isn't what you should eat, that isn't, a goat isn't something that's eaten here, it's tough, and it's, oh yeah, you don't eat that. And yeah, so it's yeah, just a sort of interesting comparison.
What do you think, like, this is a question I've got as a vegetarian and as someone who, you know, as I say, my boys are omnivorous, and seeing how sort of fashions for meat, I suppose, if that's the right phrase, have changed over the years. You know, I referenced how belly of pork was a cheap cut when I was a kid, and now it's been rehabilitated, and, you know, there's all obviously the snout to tail stuff that St. John's have done, you know, that sort of stuff. And this is a slightly strange way of putting it, but I was playing my boys a little while ago a bit of Chaz and Dave, and Rabbit came on, and there's the line in Rabbit, 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 where either Chaz or Dave goes, "He's got more rabbit than Sainsbury's," and my boys were baffled by this. They were like, "Why are they saying that?" And I said, "Well, look, when this song came out in 1982, you could go to a supermarket and you could buy rabbit."
Yeah,
and they were absolutely astonished. So, like, in your lifetimes, what changes have you seen there in terms of sort of meats that are produced, and where are we going to end up in 10, 15 years? Do you think?
I'd say as an apprentice butcher, it is, you definitely see it at the shop on the counter, because after, let's say, like, on a, after people have watched James Martin or someone cooking a recipe, they'll turn up and say, "Can I have 400 grams of X?" I'm like, I want 400. Like, there's a lady that every Friday she would have 227 grams of mince and 227 grams of diced beef. If it's 228, she kicks off. And it has to be exact. And I think, as you say, it's definitely like a, trendiness or gentrification, whatever you want to call it, because currently oxtail is more expensive than brisket. How? Like, oxtail is almost awful. Oxtail, kidney, liver is always classed as awful. But I think when you've got chefs and restaurants, I think it's good for us farmers, just sort of carcass balance, especially someone like me and Chris that sell directly. We're not selling to a wholesaler. We can get that money from like the whole animal. Like for me with pigs, like belly, I sell even trotters. People ask for trotters. Kidney I sell. Pig's ear you could dehydrate and give to make crackling or give it to dogs. And I think the point you make about rabbit, I think that's coming back.
Because is it?
When it's in season, farm shops sell rabbit. There's deer. Some places even sell squirrel, pigeon. And I think where agriculture is going and the lack of space and people saying about environmental, we are going to get to a point where people start eating insects in this country, I think. At some point that will happen. I don't think we're going to get en masse rabbit farming like you do in other countries, because I think this country's too soft, I should say. It's the same for goats. Like Chris is saying, people struggle with the concept of eating goat, whereas in Kenya, apart from chicken, goats are the unluckiest animal when there's a party, because that's the first thing you think of.
Yeah. It's hard, isn't it? It's really the whole thing about being a food producer is really adapting to your consumers. So, like, we've got to keep adapting to where consumer habits are going. You look at chicken, for example, in China, the most valuable part of a chicken is the feet. Like, so, and we sort of export it. And for example, just going on to beef, in Cumbria, speaking to a good friend of mine has a butchery business up here, and I'm obviously involved in Wagyu cattle, and we're going for a marbled product, so fattier product, because obviously that's where a lot of chefs and top chefs and restaurants want that extra flavour, the monosaturated good fats. And then in Cumbria, like if you put 6 ribeye steaks out, in most places they would leave the fattier steak. So it's really just adapting to who your consumer, finding who your consumers are, and producing a product sort of that they want, and being able to adapt to it.
It's definitely. I think you make a good point there, Chris, isn't it? Because people now have this view that they want their meat, especially, to be like fat free, and actually fat makes meat taste really good. We've got a vegetarian on the you know, Tom can't really explain convey that very well, but it does, you know. And again, it's this whole it comes back to ultra manufactured processed food, and you can have a piece of steak that's been ultra manufactured and processed, trimmed to an inch of its life. But that's I think you've given us an insight there, Tom, into why you're a vegetarian. And
I've got a question for Tom before we
go on,
take an exit. What's your thoughts on the use? I saw a story today in one of the farming magazines about whether they should ban plant-based foods being called meat-related names, like things like bacon or
tofurkey.
What's the other one? Yeah, it's like personally, if I was, I think I could give up meat. If I was to be given a choice of either meat or fish, I'd pick fish. Well, one or the other forever, I'd pick fish probably.
Yeah.
But I think if I was to be a vegetarian, that?
I'm not.
I genuinely. Chris. Listen to me. Over summer, if you have a good barbecue session on a weekend, I don't eat meat all week because I get meated out. I binge on it, and I just get, like, pork. I've eaten chicken so much at a wedding before that I didn't eat chicken for a month because I was sick. Like, I remember when I was a kid, I ate so much chicken at my dad's friend's wedding. I couldn't eat chicken for a month. So, but fish, I can eat fish every day. Seafood, I can eat that every day. So, if I was to go vegetarian, I wouldn't touch any meat, any fake, whatever. I'd just want pulses. I'd want like Indian cuisine, Thai, and all sorts. So what's your thoughts on that? Because I find if someone wants to eat meat, just eat meat. Don't call someone something a vaga. It's not a vaga. It's, I don't know, falafel. Like, you know?
It's a really interesting one. And I think it maybe depends on where you are on your sort of, if you are going to become a vegetarian on your journey, like, and your reasons for becoming vegetarian. So look, I suppose if it's more about a texture thing, then you're going to be quite keen on a plant-based stuff which has the same textures as you're used to. But for me, like, there's certain characteristics of some meat that you just don't find replicated in the vegetarian cookbook. You know, you don't really get that fibrous thing that you get with pork. There's nothing really that replicates lamb, I don't think. I mean, you know, chicken, maybe you can shape tofu into pretty much anything. So I find it a little bit strange, but I think maybe some people who have stepped away from meat for a different reason might find it an easier transition. I think I'm to be honest, Flav, I'm with you. Like, I think when I enjoy vegetarian cooking, I think it's when it really embraces what it wants to be, and it uses different flavors and it uses different textures, and it doesn't try to be something it's not. And particularly when you look at cultures where vegetarian cuisine has been dominant, like when you look at cooking from Southeast Asia, then you get an understanding that there is this vast range of different textures and flavors and things like that. So why try and do a fake version of something that you're not, when you could do a really tasty, interesting, healthy version of something else? But, you know, maybe if people are really missing meat, then that. And I think, to be honest, it feels to me a bit more like 20 years ago when you'd get bacon and stuff like that. And I have had, I went to a festival last summer and we were in a camper van, and, you know, I was the only vegetarian there, and I was cooking breakfast and I was cooking bacon for some people, and I had some bacon, and it was all a bit daft because it was even like colored to look like bacon, and it just wasn't bacon. I was like, I'll just have an egg butty. That's fine. Do you know what I mean? You were either going to eat bacon or you weren't going to eat bacon. Why eat this sort of weird pretend bacon?
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely does. It's I don't get it. One of my daughters actually is vegetarian as well. At 11, she decided 2 years ago she's going to be a vegetarian, and she, fair play to her, she stuck to it. And she eats fish and she has dairy. But you know, sometimes you'd be in the supermarket and you'd be like, you know, it makes it difficult because I eat meat. The other girls eat, my partner eats meat, and you don't like cook all. You know, you've got to cook for her separately. And sometimes you're like, Betsy, just go and choose something, will you? And she'll come back with some like ultra processed something in a packet. And I'm like, do you know what? Just go and pop that back and I'll get you some salmon. You know, something like that. Because just eat something that's proper food rather than that ultra processed.
Yeah, I think so.
What it is. So, Tom, so like moving away from food and all the rest of it, you've got a long, illustrious career, I think, in sports journalism. So, like, really, do you ever sort of, like, think to yourself, how have I ended up here? How have I ended up, like, you know, you're ghostwriting a couple of, you know, autobiographies. You know, you've obviously you're doing the stuff with Joe Marler and Geraint Thomas and other stuff. And then do you think to yourself, well, how did this happen?
Yeah, definitely. A lot of the time. I mean, when I was a kid, I'd go and watch football with my dad, but I didn't get to go to Twickenham. I didn't get to go to Lords because it was either you couldn't get tickets or it was too expensive. Never got tickets to Wimbledon. So there was a point where I was starting out where I was just, I couldn't believe that you were actually getting paid to just go to this stuff. And I was, it was almost like this weird trip where you're waiting for someone to go, hang on a second. Whoa, what's happening here? And, do you know, when I started off, I remember sneaking in, I was working for a kid's sports magazine and I used it to get tickets for pretty much every game at Twickenham I could. And I would do a little match report, but fundamentally I didn't really need to be there for the kid's sports magazine, but I just wanted to go. And I just wanted to absorb it all. I couldn't believe I was in there. And I looked around and I could see older journalists, maybe 50s, 60s, who had lost the magic. You could tell that it was just a job to them. And I remember looking and thinking, how can that ever come to pass? And that didn't happen to me. This is when I was sort of chief sportswriter at the BBC. But there was a point where I could see how it could happen to people. And it was a bit of a scary moment for me. And it was one of the reasons why I moved away from the BBC and set up the podcast company with a couple of colleagues. Because I never wanted to lose that sense of excitement I had when I was a 21-year-old kid, 22-year-old kid. Like the first time I sat on Centre Court at Wimbledon. I've watched it on TV as a kid all the time. I couldn't believe I was there. And I got really lucky with the period that I was chief sports writer. I mean, I saw Andy Murray. I was sitting on centre court when Andy Murray won Wimbledon twice. I watched England win the Ashes down under. I've seen England rugby team in three World Cup finals. I was on the finish line at London 2012, literally just above the finish line. You know, I'd run from the velodrome. I mean, I saw Usain Bolt in Beijing when he broke the world record. I saw him set two world records in Berlin, the one and the two. It was ludicrous. And then the miracle of Medina, which I know, Chris, you're going to hate me for.
Yeah, I'm raging about that.
I watched England win Cricket World Cup, the one day World Cup in 2019. I was there commentating as Geraint won the tour. You know, as a mate won the tour, I was in the commentary box. It was nuts. So there was definitely a sense of, I probably got the best decade that British sports ever had there. And yeah. I could, like I said, I hadn't lost the magic, but I never wanted to be that 50-year-old, 60-year-old who was just like, this is just a job. Because it's not just a job. And maybe the 17th time you go into Wimbledon never changes. That's part of the secret of it. It's not going to feel the same as it does the first time you go in there. And that's normal. We all get used to things. But yeah, I never wanted to lose that sense of wonder. I never wanted to lose that sense of pinching myself, of wanting to say to the 7-year-old me or the 10-year-old me or the 13-year-old me, whatever it was, fucking hell, look where we are. look where we are. And it was, to be honest, there was always a point, no matter how many pieces you wrote or how many bits of audio you did for Five Live, how many hours of commentary or chat you did, there was always a point where something would happen and you'd have to open a Word document and you'd have 2 hours to write 1,200 words. And no matter how many times you did it, there'd always be this sense of, but you always got it done. And then when you did it, and you made a connection with your audience, because that was always the thing. You weren't telling people how it was. You were trying to get a sense of, this is what it was like. Wasn't this amazing? Or be as the sort of bridge between them watching at home and you being there. And when you got it right, it was just such a fantastic feeling, you know, whether it was Super Saturday in 2012 or, yeah, Murray winning Wimbledon for the first time or Medina, whatever it was. If you were there and you managed to capture what it was like to be there, but in a way that, the part of you that had grown up a fan and was still a fan, it was wonderful. It was fantastic.
So what's the tactic in doing 1,200 words in 2 hours? Do you smash it and then go back and spell check, or do you spell check as you go along? Or
yeah, that sounds bonkers. You haven't got time to review. You've got to work out where you're going. Work out what you want to say. If you know what you want to say, it's easy. So basically 1,200 words is probably 6 points, 200 words per point. Your intro's got to be brilliant, because if your intro's no good, no one's going to bother reading the remaining 1,100 words. So put your best line at the top, either the most interesting point or the most startling point. Bring it full circle and then just know where you're going. So let's say I was at Twickenham, because I spent a lot of time at Twickenham, and you watch an England game. File your match report on the whistle. So that's 800 words of what's happened. And you go down into the bowels and you do the press conferences, have a chat with some of the players or Eddie Jones, whoever it might be. And then the clock will be ticking. So it's like, okay, what's the most interesting thing here? What's everyone going to be talking about in the pub tonight or tomorrow morning? What are we all going to be reflecting on? And then you'd sort of sense check it in your head, and then you go, okay, right, so that's the most important point. 200 words here, 200 words here. And you could actually write really quickly, and you had this internal critic. And if it was going wrong, it was almost like someone was prodding you, just going, are you sure? And you got to trust that internal critic. And if it was going well, it was like being in a sailing boat with all the sails full of air. You just went, because you knew exactly what you wanted to say. So it was always a challenge, but you could have days where it just happened, and you know, you knew you were writing good pieces when you were writing good pieces. It was a really, really nice feeling. And sometimes you file it back to the office, and you just had this massive sense of excitement, because in that secret place inside you, you knew you'd got it right, and you could not wait to see what people thought. You know, you knew that people, you'd hopefully made that connection between you and people you knew who were watching it, and you were really looking forward just to seeing what the comments might be or what the, you know, social media might say. You just thought, oh, fuck, I think I've got this one right. It was a great feeling.
You've talked about like the Medinas and Murray at Wimbledon. Is there anything that you've been to or attended that like sort of under the radar bent, where like it's not been like massive news, where you've just thought this is sport at its very best, and it's just yeah.
That is a great question, Chris. I think you could find fascination. You realise that if you, you know, Neil, the line we've got on the Joe show, which is everyone is interesting if you ask the right questions,
yeah.
which is something that both Joe and I believe, you know, it's that if you are interested in the world, then the world is an interesting place. Yeah. I think, Chris, the same is true for sports. Like, it might not be a sport you grew up with or that you ever played, but once you got into the characters who were doing it and the personalities and their motivations and their rivalries and then yeah. the mechanics of the sport, like, elite sport is really fucking hard. You know, people might make it look easy, but you know, if you've ever tried to play snooker on a full-size snooker table, everyone will go, oh my God.
It's horrific. You know,
it's ludicrous, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, it's a stupid thing going. And I'm quite a big bloke. And like, I'm like, no, forget it. Just ain't happening.
Yeah. So I think, Chris, it was, if you didn't find something interesting, the fault was probably with you. For not caring enough, of not trying to, not talking to people and not understanding it and not going, well, why is he doing this? Well, let me have a go at it. Yeah, fucking hell, that's really hard. And why do you hate you? And why does this person the best? And why that person? You had, if you immersed yourself in it, yeah. then it was always fascinating, whatever it was you're watching.
Yeah, that's very true. Like I grew, obviously, NFL, for example, has really grown in popularity here. And I just never understood the rules. And I had an injury maybe 6 or 7 years ago, and I was sort of in bed watching TV, and that rarely really happens. And I just started watching documentaries and just got so into it, and then met other people that, I think that's the thing, isn't it? It's finding other people that share your passion for sport. And once you find people that you can talk about key issues and things that are going on, that is the beauty of sport, really. It's talking about it with the other people that share the same passion as you.
Yeah. And I never, you know, this idea that sport doesn't really matter, because this is something you end up thinking about quite a lot when your whole life is sport. You know, if you do an Ashes tour, there's a point where after about 6 weeks, you suddenly have this moment where you can think, I've talked about nothing but cricket for 6 weeks. That every single conversation I've had has been about, oh, right, what's the ball going to do in Adelaide? Or, right, if you actually, you know, what does Shane Warne do? Everything is about tiny nuances. And then you think, actually, there's a lot more important things going on in the world. But I got a mate who used to work in media for the Labour Party when they were in power. And I said this to him once, because he was doing important stuff. He was doing stuff around the NHS. He was doing stuff around education. And I said to him once, I said, look, you're doing something that actually changes people's lives. I'm just dicking about with sport. And he went, yeah, but it's not just dicking about. He said, sport is the stuff that people love. You know, there are more important stuff, but you're dealing with something. It's like working in music, isn't it? Or, you know, this is the stuff that defines us. This is the stuff that we look forward to at weekends or midweeks. And, you know, these are the big sporting events that we go to. We might go with friends or our parents when we were younger, and then we take our kids. You know, these sport creates days. If you love sport, sport creates the days that you don't forget, doesn't it? The days that bring you together.
That's exactly what it does, doesn't it? I think Chris, you know, said at the beginning of the pod about, you know, looking forward to the Euros. It does bring you, you know, completely together. It really does. Like, you know, and you get behind, whether it's your football team, and, you know, I support Birmingham City, and unfortunately, there's not much to get behind them really at the moment. But when you're there, it's brilliant. It's the best thing in the world. You know, watching your team score a goal is brilliant. Watching England score a try is the best thing. You know, it really does, doesn't it? Because whatever else is going on in the world, no matter what's happening, it's gone.
Yeah.
For that 80 minutes or 90 minutes or wherever it is, or a day's like watching, well, day watching cricket is a bit different, because generally that starts off remembering stuff, and by the end of it, you can't remember.
It's a bit similar to rugby, to be fair.
Well, that is true.
But there's a lot to be said for that escape, Neil, isn't there? There's a lot to be said. Like, you know, we've all got areas of our lives that need our attention. We've all got areas of our lives that can be difficult sometimes, you know, whether it's work, whether it's family stuff, you know, relationships, whatever. And I think embracing sport as an escape, not saying it doesn't matter, but saying, look, it does matter, precisely because it enables us to be different. It enables us, you know, I always say to my little brother, the only time that me and my little brother really hug is when we're watching Wednesday and we score a goal, and then you're climbing all over each other, you know, you're jumping each other's arms, and it's not fake, it's real. It's just, that's the moment when you can express it. And I think that is really...
Yeah.
It's not a regular occurrence.
It happens twice a year.
Yeah. It does. Sport is brilliant. And like you say, like we said earlier about, you know, talking to people. And like, I think the one thing that I think, like with podcasts and why some podcasts are so, you know, good and people like it, is because it's that half an hour, whatever it might be, of pure, I'm listening to this, whatever else is going on, it doesn't matter. And especially like, you know, the one you did with Joe is, you know, it's brilliant because you learn about something that you have absolutely nothing, no idea about. And that's so, so good.
Some of the ones I've listened to, I'm like halfway through, I'm like, what? How did I get here? It's like, at the end, you tell someone about it and they look at it like I remember where I used to work as a butcher. I'd said to them one day, let's listen to this podcast as a group of us. And they're like, what? How did you get it on? Just listen. Then you finish an episode and they're all like, oh, we'll listen to the others. So yeah, I think like you say, the whole thing about asking the right questions is definitely a thing, because sometimes you ask someone a question, even in public, they'll give you one answer. But you ask the same question in a different way and you get a 5-10 minute answer.
Well, I think doing that pod as well, Neil, I mean, you know, you've come to see us in the studio and it was lovely having you there. I think sometimes without getting too pretentious about it, you know, you can look around the world and there's a lot of really fucking bad things happening, and you can have this assumption that the majority of people are bad people or that the world is an unpleasant place. But when we do those, you know, those recording days, you know, we have our three guests in one day, I think out of the 150, 160 we've done, there was one person we didn't really get on with. But almost everyone else has been someone, a complete stranger before you met them, who you got on really well with and you found interesting and you got an insight into their life. And then you felt like you could understand where they were coming from. And that is a great feeling when you leave the recording studio at the end of a day like that. It just sort of reminds you that the vast majority of people in the world are good people and you can get on with them.
No, definitely. It does. And it also, I think what it does, something like that, it actually makes somebody like, not blowing smoke up his arse, Joe, very connectable. You know, people, you know, can connect to him and see him. And I think, and it almost makes they feel like, you know, they are his friend.
Yeah.
You know, because the way it comes across, it is...
Joe, please let me on your podcast again.
Yeah.
I was being nice.
I messaged him tonight and I said, Joe, do you want to come on? And he ignored me. So that's it.
Joe, I gave you a shout out.
Yeah. Yeah. I did message him. I thought he could like pop up for a 10-minute sort of appearance, but he's obviously busy packing his bag to go to Japan.
He's going into camp. Yeah, he is. But that point you made, Neil, like, Joe makes it look very easy, but Joe is the only person I've seen who can tell people to fuck off and they're not offended. You know, he can tell a 70-year-old woman, he can look and go, fuck off. And people don't find it offensive because he is completely himself. He's completely genuine. He's got no airs and graces. He's quite honest about his own failings and struggles.
Yeah.
He's impossible not to get on with, isn't he? Mm.
No, yeah, absolutely. You know, like really, really impossible to... not get on with at all, really. I can't imagine you really sort of falling out with him.
No.
I don't know.
Mind you, ask James.
I reckon you should have a breather now, Neil, after loving Joe so much. I'm going to ask Tom a question.
Well, fuck Joe, because you didn't come on, so he can get fucking as far as I'm concerned.
If you hadn't worked in media, Tom, or now ended up in podcasting, which is related to media, what would you have done? If you had to go back again, what career would you have done? Would you go into farming and follow the family lines, or what? Yeah, what do you think you'd do?
I do think about this quite a lot, Flav, because particularly the way the Joe Show is, and you hear about different ways of making a living, I'd be so shit at so many things. Like the number of things I would be absolutely rubbish at is frightening. You know, and I think that sometimes when I'm doing what I'm doing, I'm thinking my skill base is so narrow. It's not even. Yeah. I mean, podcasts are ideal because I can just sit around and chew the fat with people. Like, that's not a job. That's just what people do on the bus or in the pub. I'd be terrible at so many things. I'm awful with numbers. I mean, I work quite hard on stuff I enjoy, but you know, it's like if you don't enjoy something, I couldn't. Yeah, I'd be terrible. You know, I'm terrible in office. I like wearing whatever clothes I want to wear. Don't really like sitting down for too long. I'd be honestly, the number of careers I would be so shit at, Flav.
Not farming then.
Well, which bit of farming? You guys know this better than me. I mean, I'd end up doing what you're doing. I'd end up doing a podcast about farming or writing about farming, wouldn't I? I think that's what I'd have to do.
I'm trying to think a job on a farm where you don't like, well, you can wear what you want on a farm, so that would be a tick. A job where you don't like sitting down, so not in a tractor. Okay. He said you don't like numbers. Yeah, there's many jobs you can do without numbers, I guess. A stock person. That probably just does.
It's all gonna go down the road of goats in a minute. You watch it.
That's right. I'm gonna be a goat man, aren't I? Yeah.
Yeah, so there's a recurring theme on this podcast. and our logo has a goat on a bale because these two boys here have goats and they are like trying week in, week out to convince me to buy goats. And
you bought a tractor, so you're gonna buy goats soon.
On a previous guest, before we came, I tried to get him to buy a chicken shed.
Yeah, that was true. Yeah, we're trying to sell anything, but I'm not going to buy any fucking goats. So it will go. Flav is basically going to say, Tom, you would make a really, really good goat man.
Mm-hmm.
So, well, on that,
I'm going to ask Tom before we did wrap it up. Is it coming home?
Oof. The odds are against it coming home, Chris. I think it's more likely to go back to France or Germany. But you never know. Look, my dad was very lucky. He was a young man in London eating his cuts of meat in 1966. And before the World Cup began, he got a block of tickets for every game at Wembley. And it didn't cost him very much. So he saw every single game in the 1966 World Cup play by England, including the final, you know, and every time that England get knocked out of a tournament, he sends pretty much the same message to the family WhatsApp group, which is, I hope that one day you lot get to see what I saw.
What is the issue though? Like, what is the issue with, I've always asked myself this question, because you can't say they don't have the passion, because I hope they do. I think they do. And like the amount of money that's in FA, so they've got everything. And so I've never understood why England don't do well.
We could do an entire series of podcasts on this, but my short answer would be that international football is now incredibly competitive in a way that it wasn't before. You've now got a situation where all the players play against all the other players all the time. So there are no secrets in international football, whereas even if you could, the first World Cup I remember was 1982, and I'd never seen Paolo Rossi, who was the top scorer for Italy. I'd never seen Zico, who was the superstar for Brazil. I'd never seen Maradona, because, you know, there was the European Cup, but most overseas players stayed at home. So I think there is a level of competition that there hasn't been before. I mean, just in terms of the number of teams now in international tournaments, you know, the Euros used to be 16 teams and it's just crept up and up and up. So it's more matches. I think one of the problems for England is the duration and the intensity of the Premier League season.
Yeah.
You know, you get the end of the season and most top players have been playing Premier League, European Cup, Champions League rather. They've played FA Cup. They've played an extraordinary number of games and you get to June and they're knackered. You know, they're knackered. We play more games at higher intensity. And even though the Premier League is not as competitive as it once was, most games in the Premier League are more competitive than they are in La Liga or in the Bundesliga or in Serie A. If you're a top player for Real Madrid or a top player for Barcelona, you get four or five tough games a season. You know, El Clasico and then Atletico Madrid. A lot of the other games aren't even close. Bayern Munich until this year, totally dominant. Same in Italy with Juve. So I think there is that level for England players of just day after day, week after week, intense matches. And you get to someone, there's not always that much left.
Yeah. You look as well. To win a major tournament, you need luck.
Yeah. You need. I think you probably need a couple of players who are at the absolute peak. Yeah. And, you know, it is possible for England this time. You know, Harry Kane is probably the best at what he does, his particular version of being being a striker. He's probably the best in the world at that. Bellingham is a game changer. Saka's a fantastic player. I think we are probably a little bit short in defence. I think we would like more options there. I think Southgate has probably done the right thing by going, do you know what, I'm going to give some of these youngsters a chance. I'm going to give Maynard a chance. I'll build the team around Maynard and Bellingham and Saka. But we shall see. You never know. I mean, worse teams than England have won major tournaments in quite recently.
Well, fingers crossed that England bring it home. That would be good. And on that positive note of England winning the Euros, I'd just like to thank Tom for your time this evening. And hopefully it's not been hope it's not been too bad. And thanks again.
Well, listen, thanks for having me. I'm really glad I could come on. Thanks for being patient as we sorted out a date, Neil.
Yeah.
Chris, Flav, thanks for having me on your pod. I've really enjoyed it.
Thank you, Tom.
It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you.
Well, that was a fantastic and different podcast, I think you can say, we recorded there. All the ones we've done so far have all been Farming Central. I mean, we've just spent an hour talking to somebody that has roots in agriculture, but is very, very much not part of it.
Yeah, definitely. I think it's just good to get other people's perspective on it. And again, like we've mentioned, I think sometimes as farmers, some of the community are quick to sort of push against anyone that chooses to be vegetarian or vegan. At the end of the day, it's people's choice. And it was quite nice to hear his sort of well thought out, well reasoned argument of why he's chosen that. Yeah, it was a really refreshing podcast. And I think it flowed really well, didn't it?
It was brilliant. And I think I also like the fact that he didn't impose his vegetarianism on his children. His children, let them have a choice. His teenage boys, they can have a choice and they're choosing to eat meat, which I think is a really good thing.
And also I think the point Chris made there about sometimes us farmers getting quite, especially us livestock farmers, getting our backs up a bit when we hear someone's vegetarian or vegan. We've got to remember that they're eating at the end of the day. So unless they're eating concrete, if they're eating something we can produce, then it's good for us anyway, because some of us do grow crops that people that don't eat meat buy. So, yeah, we can't complain, really.
I think as farmers, if we're going to criticise people for eating processed vegan food, then we've also got to accept people that eat good quality vegetarian food as well, because at the end of the day, it is a choice.
Definitely. And I think, obviously, there's a bit of timing with the releasing of this podcast that hopefully we'll all be watching England beat Holland this evening, and hopefully it won't go to penalties. And obviously, we did talk a lot about farming, but Chris, you're the sports fan. You had, as you quoted, one of the best conversations you've ever had with a sports journalist. So it was like your dream come true, chatting to essentially what is BBC's number one sports journalist for many years. So do you want to talk about the football? Because you're the expert.
Well, what I was saying about penalties, Neil, because those five penalties at the weekend were some of the best penalties I've ever seen. And for England to be going into a game not worried about going to penalties is quite miraculous after all the years of hurt in penalty shootouts with Stuart Pearce and Chris Waddle and Saka. And yeah, it's and Southgate himself. Yeah. So yeah, it hasn't been pretty, but look, whatever you say, positive or negative about Southgate, he gets us into the later round. So come on, boys, we're all behind you. Let's bring it home.
Yeah, definitely.
I hope we don't go to penalties, even though we're good at them now. Because that was sickly. Watching that, my stomach was, I couldn't do it. I don't want to be going through that again.
It's, I think we're quite accustomed to penalties. And I think you're right, Chris. I was, just as a kid and growing up and all through my adult life, I think it's pretty much our penalties. You might as well just turn the telly off and go out.
because we're going to lose, basically. Whereas you're absolutely right on the weekend there, it was absolutely phenomenal. And Ivan Toney's no-look penalty is just a thing of legend.
Yeah. But obviously on this podcast, we're trying to bring topical conversations. And really, when you think about it, I know this episode maybe wasn't as just focused on some of the issues in farming like many of the others, but the link between agriculture and farming is very strong. There's a lot of professional athletes who come from farming backgrounds and then go back to the farming business when they've finished playing sport. You look at Alistair Cook, Rory Best, to name just a few. So it's hopefully a lot of our listeners found it interesting and share the love of sport that we do as well.
Yeah, definitely. Cool. Well, don't forget to like, follow us on social media, subscribe to us on Spotify, and then subscribe to us also on Apple, because we will be on Apple very soon, which is very exciting. So follow us there and just subscribe and like and follow us everywhere you can. And we'll see you next time.